is the World of Work podcast with James
and Jane.
Hi, this is James. I wanted to let you know that as well as these podcasts, we deliver at least one free online seminar every month that you're welcome to attend wherever you are in the world. You can learn more about them and register for them via our website, www.worldofwork.io. That's www.worldofwork.io. Hello, and welcome to this episode of A World of Work podcast. Super exciting topic today, super exciting guest. We're going to be speaking to Charlotte Ray. She's a lecturer in psychology at the University of Sussex here in the UK, and she's been doing a lot of research on the four-day week, which is a subject we're really interested in exploring. We're curious about its impacts on individual well-being and performance, and to some extent, its role in shaping the way of working in our societies. And we just think it's a great thing to try and unpick. Charlotte, before we get into the podcast, could you say hi to the guests and introduce yourself to them as well, please?
Hello, delighted to join you. So I'm Dr. Charlotte Ray from the University of Sussex, and I specialise in studying the biology of well-being at work. And when I first saw the media headlines on the four-day week, 3 years or so ago now, I thought, oh, I must do a study on that. I want to figure out what's going on inside people's heads when they undertake that switch.
Yeah, lovely. That's so cool, right? And we picked up on some of this language about the four-day week, that shift to the popular mindset around that time as well. So it's great to speak to somebody who's been doing real research exploring the impacts of a four-day week from multiple dimensional levels. That's really interesting. Maybe we can start at the beginning. Could you just tell us a little bit about what a four-day week is, right? What are we actually talking about? Do we just have Fridays off? I mean, what is it we're talking about?
Yeah, so the four-day week is a great catchphrase. And I think many people intuitively go towards an assumption of, oh, right, that means we're closed on Fridays. And indeed, that is the case for some organisations who choose to adopt a four-day working week. But honestly, there are as many ways of doing a four-day week as there are organisations. The implementation looks different for everyone. And sometimes it's not even necessarily 4 days that you spend at work. So some other flavours to this are, for example, a nine-day fortnight, where you might have one day, extra day off every 2 weeks, or perhaps five shorter days. And if there are part-time staff who are currently working 4 days and are paid for 4 days, then there we might be talking about a proportionate reduction in time at work for them too. But what all of these scenarios have in common is an overall reduction in the amount of time that staff spend at work across the length of the working week. So generally, we're not talking about a four-day week of compressed hours, where staff work the same number of hours over four very long days, because there's no overall reduction the amount of time spent at work. And the idea of reducing time at work is so that you can bank some well-being benefits and have staff who are really better rested, so that then when they are at work, they're firing on all cylinders and just much better able to achieve.
Yeah, lovely. So I guess the four-day week anchors in on a 20% reduction in time at work fundamentally is what we're capturing. Though it needn't be exactly that. It's the reducing of time we spend in work or on work, leading to benefits to well-being and through that performance and, I guess, engagement and experience.
That's it. Exactly. And many organisations will go for a 20% reduction, but some will go for slightly less, say a 10% reduction under a nine-day fortnight model, or it might be somewhere between 10 and 20%. So, for example, we have one organisation, an architects firm, who went from 37.5 hours over 5 days down to 34 hours over 4 days. So each working day lengthened ever so slightly, but nevertheless, there's still a slight reduction in the amount of hours spent at work.
Yeah, fabulous. And we'll talk about some of the benefits and impact of this in a little bit. But when we do, I'll be curious to see about whether, you know, that first hour saved leads to the biggest impact or how this translates. I think it's such a rich and interesting topic. When I look through your CV and your background, one of the things I noticed is that you've moved into this space and you're drawn to this space coming from a background of, I guess, sort of core psychology and neuroscience, which I think is really interesting. So having come out of a neuroscience world, what was it about this idea of a four-day week that sort of hooked you and drew you in? What's that drive?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. My background actually is I'm a neuroscientist by training, and my background is in using MRI brain scanning to understand how the mind works. And previously, a lot of my neuroscience work had been in populations who have particular diagnoses, whether that's a neurological diagnosis, say a neurodegenerative condition like Parkinson's disease, or maybe a mental health condition. And that's fantastic work, but lots of other people are tackling that in academic neuroscience. And increasingly, I got really interested in well-being in the general population, because I do feel, even if you don't meet diagnostic criteria for, say, clinical depression at a given moment in time, it doesn't mean you're not vulnerable. And I think the way the world is now and the way the world of work is now, with a lot of pressure for many people, if we think about us all lying along a spectrum, just because at this point in time, clinically anxious or depressed, it doesn't mean that you might be vulnerable to that. And therefore, I wanted to do a study more around kind of risk and vulnerability, and that was relevant to everyone in the population rather than just people who meet a certain cutoff on a, you know, questionnaire. And then I saw the media headlines on the four-day week, and I thought, that's it. That's what I want to figure out of the journey, the psychological journey, and even the biological, physiological journey that staff are going on. Because even, you know, 3 years ago, it was clear from the early trials that productivity was often going up and that staff reported feeling healthier and happier. And I think the well-being benefits are in many respects pretty intuitive, pretty obvious. But I really wanted to understand more about the brain basis behind those media headlines.
Yeah, lovely. I love that phrase, the biological journey that we're going on. I think that's a really interesting phrase to bring into this, and a very interesting thing to think about here. You've been working with a range of different businesses, and obviously, as you've said, there have been media headlines on this for a long time. One of the first ones I remember was, I think Microsoft in Japan came out with some research about 3 or 4 years ago. That's when I first started to really look at some of the evidence behind this. What sort of organizations do you see adopting this type of work? And I guess one of the questions in that is do you see a difference between type of labor or types of work that different organizations do that draw them to focusing on affordability?
Yes, there are definitely some very clear trends here, whereby if you look at the national trial, which ran in 2022, this included 61 employers employing nearly 3,000 people. And there are some clear trends in that knowledge economy sectors tend to be the most popular currently to trial a four-day working week. And that mirrors exactly what we're seeing in our own study on the biology of the four-day week as well. So the kinds of companies doing work like digital marketing, agencies, professional services. And I think this is currently the most popular sector for organisations to trial a four-day week, because on the surface, it's a little easier to identify how we can make small tweaks, small adaptations to people's working routines, to people's working habits, essentially to psychology, to find the efficiencies that will bank up over the course of the week to enable people to then have that time off. So a lot of the common adaptations for knowledge economy work will be around looking at meetings, how long do you have meetings for, how many people are they with, and workplace habits around switching off email and minimizing distractions when you need to concentrate on a particular task and your most important outputs. Having said that, although there's a clear trend whereby the knowledge economy sector is the most popular area to trial a four-day working week, there are plenty of other sectors giving this a try too. And so in the national trial, there were some healthcare organisations, and we have also worked with a residential care company. Here the implications are slightly different, both in terms of the adaptations to the structure of the work and the working week, but also in terms of the outcomes that organisations are seeking. So with our residential care company, in order to cover the rota, they did have to hire an extra member of staff. And obviously there are significant financial implications of that. But they were very worried about retention and recruitment. And I'm sure it won't be a surprise to any of your listeners that certainly in the UK, at least, you know, the care sector is really struggling with retention and recruitment. And over the course of the trial, no one left. And also that the nature of the particular care work that this organisation were doing was with young adults with autism, where building up close relationships and retaining staff was really important. And they felt that it led to a much higher service in terms of provision of care. And some of the human stories that we heard were fantastic around the staff feeling that they weren't snapping at each other so much because they were just better rested. And that then filtered through to the experience of the people receiving the care as well. So there are these different financial implications, different adaptations to the working week that need to be made, but also slightly different facets of the outcomes that are being sought across these different sectors.
Yeah. And listening to you speak about that, I perceive or get the sense that there are different levels or types of effortfulness required in different roles that benefit in different ways from some of the benefits we achieve through a reduced working week. So we've got, I guess, physical labor, we've got emotional labor, some of that sort of care type work that you speak about is effortful in a big way, or creativity from an agency perspective. There are lots of different types of things that benefit in different ways, presumably to different extents, I would speculate as well. So the phrases that we've talked about a few times as you've been talking about this, we've talked about sort of the adaptations and the changes to work, and we'll come on to those in a minute, that enable this. But what we've also talked about, some of the impacts that lead to benefits being impacts related to well-being and impacts related to performance. So when we're talking about well-being and we're trying to pin down what some of the benefits are for well-being, what are the things that you're looking at? What are those markers of well-being that you're trying to focus on?
Yes. Well, in our particular research study, we've been taking a very long list of, of measures of well-being. But just to start off with some of our headline findings so far, we've been looking at mental health, and that goes for depression, anxiety, and stress. And that goes for work-related burnout. We've also been looking at lifestyles, so sleep, diet, and exercise. And often these are assessed with questionnaires, but we've also been getting some more objective measurements too, using actigraphy. So wearables, many of your listeners might have, you know, a Fitbit or a Garmin watch. And some of our participants have kindly been wearing research-grade watches for us. And from that, we can objectively determine what's happening to someone's sleep in terms of sleep duration, sleep efficiency, and sleep quality, alongside what they tell us they're experiencing in the questionnaires. And from that, we can also get some measures of people's physical activity levels to complement, again, their subjective perception of how that aspect of lifestyle is changing for them from the questionnaires. Then for those employees who are up for it and up for visiting us on the University of Sussex campus for some more detailed well-being tests, we've been running MRI brain scans to look at brain function and how that might change when people are better rested and less stressed. And also taking a blood sample to look at the immune system and how active the immune system is, because there's a marker of this circulating in people's bloodstreams that we can pick up with quite a simple blood test. And these markers, they're called inflammatory cytokines. We know from lots of other occupational research, these start spiking in your bloodstream if you're doing shift work, if you're not sleeping well, and if you're experiencing a lot of stress. And unfortunately, we know that these molecules are actually risk factors for depression and also for dementia, because they can actually cross the blood-brain barrier and physically get into the brain and cause inflammation. So those aspects of the study are still very much ongoing, and we're looking to get some larger sample sizes. But already we can see from the questionnaires that mood is improving, people experience more frequent positive emotions and less frequent negative emotions. We can see that burnout is going down, and we actually take this on a weekly basis, so over 12 weeks as they're shifting to the four-day week and engaging in all these fantastic new work habits. And you can see literally week by week burnout going down and sleep problems going down. So the longer people have been on the four-day week and the more time they've banked, the better and better they're feeling across multiple dimensions of well-being and lifestyle.
Yeah, fabulous. Could you just unpick for us burnout a little bit more? So we referred to it a few times. Could you break down a little bit what you're speaking about here?
Yes. So to measure burnout, that there are many ways of doing this, but a very well-used approach to measuring burnout in psychological studies of the world of work is using the Maslach Burnout Inventory. So this is a short questionnaire that asks specifically about burnout in the work context. So we're not talking about burnout relating to other aspects of people's lives, such as, you know, care responsibilities. And there are three dimensions of burnout that this questionnaire taps into. The first is called emotional exhaustion. So this is essentially how worn down you feel by work. And it asks questions like, at the end of the working day, I just feel totally used up. So it's relating to tiredness. Then the second dimension of burnout that this scale measures is called depersonalization. So this is where you start to feel less positively inclined towards your colleagues. And this asks questions like, I care less about how my colleagues feel nowadays, or I've become insensitive to what my colleagues are feeling. And I think that dimension is particularly interesting in the context of care work and emotional labour. And then the third dimension is called personal accomplishment. So ideally on a four-day week, you want to see emotional exhaustion coming down and depersonalization coming down. But on the flip side, you want to see personal accomplishment going up. So this is feeling like you're accomplishing worthwhile things while you're at work. And so if you're feeling low in burnout, you'll have low emotional exhaustion, low depersonalization, and typically high personal accomplishment.
Lovely. That's really helpful. Thank you. And that's a lovely layer to bring more insight across this. How fabulous that this is being linked to a lot of the biological factors that you call out. It's great to have that evidence base from a scientific perspective overlapping in what we're doing. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and one comment that we hear quite a lot is, you know, the subjective self-report questionnaires are really valuable because they capture how people are feeling. But of course, self-report questionnaires, there can be some pros and cons to this. One being that if the employer is going to be seeing the results of the questionnaires, which is what we do at the end of each trial, we write a custom report for the employer on what we've seen change for their staff. Consciously or unconsciously, you might be slightly motivated to report better scores after the switch to the 4-day working week. And we do try to tackle this even before we get to the biology of, we take some control questionnaire measures that one wouldn't expect a 4-day week to change, because they're stable features of the organisation or stable personality characteristics. And reassuringly, we've seen that the scores on those are very static, which suggests that the staff aren't at least setting out to gain the questionnaires. But alongside the questionnaires, we feel this is why it's really, one reason why it's really valuable to take the biological data is, in the words of one of our HR managers, you can't fake a blood sample or an MRI scan.
At least not without a whole lot of effort, right? I mean, it's not going to be worth it for someone else.
Yeah.
And in terms of then moving on from those well-being factors, when we talk about performance, we've already talked about some of the factors of performance. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about that measurement of performance and what you're focusing
yes,
on?
Yes, absolutely. So in the national trial, at least anyway, there's some really useful performance data in terms of managers' reports and perceptions of their team's functions, and a slight boost, not a massive boost, but a slight boost to performance as rated by managers. In the national trial, there was also a slight increase in revenue. When it comes to our data, where we've been taking quite a more detailed picture on what's going on, in the national trial is fantastic because it was mass scale. Ours is a smaller sample size, usually working with SMEs, but we're taking a much deeper dive into the performance changes that take place. So we take both subjective measures and some more objective measures of performance. And when it comes to the self-report, we're getting staff to self-rate productivity, and then at the end of the week, and we do this on a weekly basis, tell us how well they feel they ticked off their to-do list in the week, essentially. Interestingly, as soon as staff switch to the reduced hours, this jumps up about 5 to 10%, and then they generally maintain that high level of performance throughout the rest of the trial period. And we can perhaps talk a little bit more about the reasons for that. But just superficially, one reason is that we do a lot of preparatory work with organisations before they switch on what are the behavioural habit changes going to need to be in order to get that productivity boost. Some other self-report measures we've been getting are job satisfaction, commitment to the organisation and intention to stay with the company. Because as well as productivity, for example, with the care company, they were actually more interested in retention rates. And interestingly, this goes up around 10-15%. So these aren't radical, massive changes. And I would say in general, you're coming from a place where there's definitely room and scope for improvement, but generally it's not a complete catastrophe. And we're able to get boosts of, say, 5, 10, sometimes up to 20% on more of the well-being measures. But we don't take people to complete perfection and scoring at the top of the range on all of the questionnaires. And I think maybe in some respects that shows that this is quite a valid measure. You know, if we perfected everything, maybe people might be a bit suspicious.
Yes, I'd say so.
Yeah. And of course, beyond the 4-day week, there are many, many other aspects of what influences job satisfaction, what influences productivity. So it's not necessarily always a silver bullet, but we do see that it's quite effective at tapping into many dimensions of well-being and many dimensions of performance and workplace experience. And then we come on to some of the more objective measures. This tends to be on a little bit more of a custom basis between employers because everyone's work is different. Some of the nice things about self-report measures are you can cut across all these different types of work and job roles. But when you come to objective performance, even within an organisation, there may need to be different metrics for different teams. But some of the common measures that we've worked with companies to identify what their markers of success are things like if it's a customer service team and they're taking phone calls, how many phone calls are they answering? How long are they spending on the phone with each client? And how many sales are made as a result of the phone calls? Also, if it's email support, how many IT support tickets have you closed that day or that week? And then, of course, revenue. There are many, many factors that influence revenue, cost of living crisis, all the turmoil that's happening. But it's nevertheless at least reassuring to see that your revenue isn't markedly dropping off during a four-day week trial period.
That's a great mix of things in there. And you sort of played down a bit that 5 to 15 to 20% impact. But from a business perspective, I mean, that's a huge impact. And on a personal perspective, that's quite a big impact as well, I would say, really.
Yes, absolutely. And when participants come into us for their MRI scans and we get to have a little bit more of a chat with them about what life has been like, that's where they start to use the words like transformative, or so that, you know, 5, 10, 20%. Nevertheless, really alters people's experience, both inside and outside of work.
Yeah, that's great. I just wanted to unpick it a little bit because it seems such a potentially huge impact. Based on the stuff that you've been doing, have you got any sort of anything that you want to call out as a particularly highlighted result? Anything that you're particularly interested in? Anything that stood out for you that you were like super excited to see or really proud of?
Yes,
you know, sort of vicariously for impact? Yeah.
Yeah.
What are those?
My favourite result so far, and the study's very much still ongoing and we'll be collecting data on a rolling basis and we want to keep supporting as many employers as we can on the journey. Our most exciting result so far for me comes from our questionnaires looking at the association between well-being and performance. So what I did was I calculated how much did someone's well-being improve when they switched to the four-day week, and that's across all the well-being measures that I've talked about, and how much did their workplace experience change when they switched to the four-day working week. And then I tested for an association, in scientific terms it's called a correlation, between well-being and performance. And what we saw is that the more someone's sleep improved, the more their productivity went up, and then the more that someone's burnout improved, the more their work motivation and enthusiasm went up. And very interestingly, those results were quite specific to those individual dimensions of well-being and performance, because there was no association between sleep and workplace enthusiasm and motivation, and there was no association between burnout and productivity. And I'm excited about this because of the three really important things that it tells us scientifically about the four-day week. The first is that well-being is inextricably linked to performance and workplace experience. And I think everyone listening to this podcast will intuitively know that, but here are the hard numbers, the hard data to prove it. Secondly, it tells us that individual dimensions of well-being map onto individual dimensions of workplace experience. And so if you improve one aspect of well-being, that's great. You might well improve one aspect of workplace performance, but you won't necessarily be able to improve multiple dimensions. And if you want to improve multiple dimensions of workplace experience, then you probably need to improve multiple dimensions of well-being. And the four-day week, I think, is a fantastic, efficient intervention to simultaneously hit those multiple dimensions all in one go. Whereas instead, if you, say, put on a gym class for people, then you might improve exercise, but say not sleep or burnout, or put in place a program around mental health, you might improve anxiety and depression symptoms, but not necessarily exercise. So the four-day week can help you hit all of those things in one go.
Lovely. I love the fact that it's not a simple outcome, right? It's not one to many in terms of the impact that it has. And also often when we look at organizations and speak to organizations that are creating interventions, they adopt an approach of, like you say, doing one thing and focusing on the impact of one thing without considering that holistic approach. So when we then talk about the fact that a four-day week brings multiple things and brings space for, I guess, these multiple correlating factors that improve engagement, enthusiasm, experience, productivity, what are the different aspect that you think the four-day week brings that lets it be such a multifaceted impact?
Yeah, I think it's largely to do with rest, but resting in quite a structured way. So when we give people that extra time off, what it means is that they're not trying to cram everything that isn't work into quite a small chunk of time. Staff tell us some quite personal stories about what they're getting up to on their newly free fifth day, but also about how that's changing their experience of life throughout the rest of the week as well, on the days that they are at work and weekend days or days that they would normally not be working. So there's a lot of shifting of life admin and chores from the weekend or from evenings to that fifth free day. And so staff are telling us the weekend is freed up for rest and for looking after themselves and for spending time with friends and family. And there's so much psychological evidence around mental health that sleep, diet and exercise and spending time with friends and family are so good for both physical health and mental health. And we think that that then also filters through to sleep. And we still need to analyse the sleep watch data, but we take it for a period of 2 weeks during the baseline before staff switch, and then again towards the end of the trial, because a suspicion is that sleep is actually improving across the length of the working week, because people are less stressed about trying to fit everything into life that needs to be fitted in 2024. They're better able to sleep across the length of the whole week. We also have seen in our questionnaires that staff are reporting higher psychological detachment. So that this is a bit of a jargony word, but essentially what we mean by that is how easy staff find it to switch off from work at the end of the working day. And that's largely applying to those 4 days that they are at work, or five if it's five shorter days and so on. But the fact that that's happening on the days that they are at work, we then think that's leading to an improvement in sleep following the working day as well. So through these multiple mechanisms, really, we think we're able to improve sleep throughout the working week, as well as on days that they would have otherwise not normally been at work. And then from what we know of all the neuroscience and the psychology research on how sleep affects the brain, I think what's going on is when staff are better rested and sleeping better, their brain function is optimized. And I think that that is what is ultimately behind these performance wins that we see. And so I'm hoping with our study, we're going to be able to provide the scientific evidence. And in those early weeks of the switch to the 4-day week, there is a lot of behavioral change that needs to happen of these new habits to really optimize productivity. And again, I think the better sleep is helping people better adjust and embed those habits, because the brain is in a more receptive state.
Yeah, lovely. So as you speak, it sounds very systemic to me. You know, if we can address these different factors, we improve somebody's sleep, we improve their restedness. Through that, we make it easier for them to self-regulate or new behaviors and do all these things fit together. And presumably, this is a bit of a multiplier impact to some extent. It's that virtuous cycle that comes with some of the things that we're speaking about. Does that sound fair to you?
Yeah, absolutely. And a virtuous cycle in terms of, because we can see in the questionnaires, people feeling better and better and better week by week by week.
Yeah. Interesting. And so I guess one of the things I'm curious about is the feedback we get from the actions we take impacts us and the things that we do and how we feel. So if we have people doing this and they feel like, oh, you know, I'm doing this, I'm taking this action, my productivity is improving, my experience is improving. It's a nice positive piece of feedback that presumably reinforces some of this and helps people experience. If people don't feel that they're getting an improved experience at work or don't feel validated through their connections and community at work, does that impact the effectiveness of this type of intervention?
I think ultimately any work outcome is driven by human behavior and driven by human psychology, because work is humans performing human behavior. Even when you bring AI into the mix, that's created by humans and humans are interacting with it. And so if you're not excited about your work and you're not motivated about your work, your brain is just not going to put as much into the outputs. And you probably don't need a PhD in neuroscience to know that. But subjectively, we all know that from our own experiences of the world of work, don't we?
Yeah. Power of those beliefs and impacts and experience we have is pretty... If we just take it a bit more personally, has this changed your work? I mean, how do you work now? What's your relationship with work?
Yes. So it has changed it. I would say probably 5, 10, 20% in that it hasn't completely altered my work experience. But in working with employers, even before we get to all the scientific measurements we've been doing, we've learned a huge amount about the journey they go on before they switch, as well as what happens after they switch, because there does need to be a fair amount of preparation to identify, again, as we said earlier, no two organisations are the same. It looks different for each business. So what are the adaptations going to need to be to make this happen and make it a success? And through a lot of that preparatory work and those preparatory conversations, we've learned a lot about the tweaks and the efficiencies that businesses can make. And so through that, I started adopting a lot of that myself. And we used the phrase virtuous cycle earlier. That's become a really virtuous cycle for me, because then in implementing it myself, it's given me the best possible insight into what it's like for staff on the receiving end of the prescriptions that the doctor is giving for tweaks to habits. So that a lot of the common knowledge economy adaptations, and that's the nature of the work that I do, office-based, desk-based, a mixture of meetings and cognitively demanding, often creative work, looking carefully about meetings. So an adaptation that I made was, instead of on my Calendly meeting scheduler having the default meeting length as half an hour instead of an hour, and also being very strict with myself about when I'm engaging in work communications and emails versus when I'm not, so that I'm not constantly pinging back and forth. Before I started doing a four-day week myself, which I started doing in January, through these productivity efficiencies, I started to feel that I was getting 6 days of work done in five. And as an academic, my time has been quite split between research and enjoying working with employers versus teaching, which was also incredibly rewarding. But I realized, actually, I'd like to do 5 days of work in four. So I actually made a structural change for myself to accommodate that. And I got a research grant that actually is now paying my salary, which means all of my time is now focused on supporting employers and research in a four-day week. And because the university no longer has to pay my salary, that means I no longer am teaching. So for me, it's been a combination of the productivity wins and the good habits and the efficiencies, combined with looking at, in the wider context of my organisation, how work was kind of allocated. So it's work redesign on two levels, that the smaller day-to-day and then the larger day-to-day as well. And depending on the complexity of the organisation, sometimes there's a little bit more preparatory work needed on those kind of longer term organisation shuffles. If it's a smaller organisation, sometimes it's more just about tips and tricks for the day-to-day efficiencies.
Do you have any thoughts on the importance of a belief of leadership and sponsorship of these types of interventions in the run-in? If you have a cynic, does it lead to failure? What's your incidental or anecdotal thoughts on that?
I think there's probably two things to unpack there. And first is around the modelling, because we ask all the staff in the study, how much work did you do on your newly free fifth day? And we see that for most employees, they generally stick to it and report not doing any work. But the more senior you are in the organisation, we do see the more senior leaders, particularly the business owners, reporting at least on some of the days they're doing a little bit of work. It's still a lot less than they would otherwise have been doing, but they say they actually really like having a quiet couple of hours. And then they'll go off and enjoy the rest of the day. So it is harder for the senior leaders, where they're so passionate and so motivated. And sometimes they'll say, oh, it doesn't actually feel too much like work. So we do find them doing a little, checking in a little bit. However, I do still think it's really important that they're not working the whole day. And their staff then, when they come back to work, seeing emails that have been sent, you know, throughout the working day. Because otherwise, it's going to send some messaging around, well, have we really given you a four-day week? And then you had another part to that question around cynics. My experience has been, when an employer trials a four-day week, sometimes it's come from the staff and the staff have prompted it and say in an appraisal, and the business owner has gone, oh, you know what, actually, oh yeah, let's give it a try. But I would say more often it's been the business leader who's decided, I think this might be a good thing for us. Sometimes they want it for themselves and then feel, well, if I'm going to have it, then the rest of the team should have it. Generally, there tends to not be a lot of cynicism from the business owner, because if they've got to the point of trialing a four-day week, they think in principle it's probably going to be a good thing. But when you look at the wider organisation as a whole, because more often than not, it has been the decision of the senior leader, there may be some pockets of staff within the organisation who are not so on board. And we have seen this, certainly. It's more a minority case, but that doesn't mean it's not important. And in fact, those are the staff who we probably need to listen to the hardest, particularly in the preparatory phase. And sometimes this is worries around how we're going to get all the work done. Yeah, I love the idea of it in principle, but I'm really worried about getting the work done. And sometimes this is where it's the middle management or a kind of sub-team manager who worries that, you know, maybe the staff they're supervising aren't going to lean in so much, and then it's going to fall on their shoulders that the trial hasn't been a success. And I think the way to support these staff is to make sure you're doing the preparatory work and having those early conversations on how are we going to adapt the working week to accommodate this. And a lot of the role that I play is facilitating those conversations. Actually, the staff are the ones who know their work the best. They have the solutions, they just don't know it. Those early conversations can help draw that out. Then you've got another group of people who are a little bit more intractable, whereby just in terms of sort of personal values and personal mindset, it just doesn't gel for them and it just doesn't feel so natural. Demographically, there's a trend here that they tend to be older and tend to be men more than women. And I think it's partly a demographic and personality and characteristic mindset around, oh, my colleagues don't work as hard as me, or they're just not going to take work as seriously, and or they just really love work and they want to spend that time working. And what I say to employers is, what you're doing with this intervention is you're just giving people the choice over whether to work or not. And if someone wants to work on that day, lots of employers, you know, don't need to stop them from doing so, other than the kind of modelling. But I do have one employer whereby there was a more senior member of staff who actually it was affecting their mental health to take that time off. And so for them, the adaptation was, well, you stick on your original hours then. So again, we come back to 4 day weeks, a handy catchphrase, but flexibility of it is paramount. Flexibility across different organizations, even within an organization, and finding the solution that is right for that team.
Yeah, there's some really interesting stuff. And I think it would be fascinating at some point to explore the sort of imposition of a 4 day week on an organization and see what that led to in terms of impact. Some of your points there about maybe leading to some sort of values conflict or perception of self-worth or social status, yeah. All those things are really interesting and could be added stressors, as you indicated, for some of the individuals that you've spoken about. Pre-work does seem really important to this. What do you think some of the risk factors are that organizations might have if they don't think appropriately in advance, plan, structure? What are some of the cautionary things that you'd call out to stop people just marching headlong into implementing whatever it is, a 4 day week?
Yeah. Well, we've talked quite emphasized, preparatory work's so important. Mm. At the same time, and I'll give some detail on that, but same time, I do think that if the motivation is there from the senior staff and in informal chats with the boots on the ground, as it were, there's general curiosity and interest. Honestly, I think the risks are lower than many organisations think they are. And I think many organisations, the biggest hurdle is more around just making the leap of, we haven't done this before and we don't necessarily know anyone else who's done it. And we just can't work out what it would look like. We can't quite put together how we would back, you know, find the efficiencies to bank the time off. And so they don't take the leap. And they're often worried about, what do we tell our client? What do we do about part-timers? But the good news is there are answers to all of these questions, because in the UK, at least, there are now literally hundreds of employers who have done this. So whatever the answer is, whatever the question is, there is an answer for it. And we just need to link you up with the right people to give you that confidence that there are solutions to all of these conundrums. And once you've been given the confidence boost that there are those answers and solutions, I think that then de-risks it for people, because it starts to become a bit more material. You can envisage what this is going to look like, what it's going to feel like, what the shape of the working week is going to be. But then to de-risk that jump as much as possible, preparatory work, whether that's with me, whether it's linking up with another similar organisation who have done this. And the 4 Day Week Campaign UK have a list of accredited employers on their website. So that's 4dayweek.co.uk. And from that, you can see all the different sectors that people are in. And generally, once people have made the switch and they've gone public that they've made the switch, they're generally quite open and happy to chat about how they did that and what the impact has been. So there will be someone out there similar to you who's done it. If you can't find that listed on the 4dayweek.co.uk website, of course you can ask me or contact the 4 Day Week campaign themselves, because they also have a fantastic overview of the UK landscape of who has been trialing a 4 Day Week and making a success of it.
Yeah. I've got a couple of sort of things I've been thinking about that are a little bit more tangential, I guess, to this, but I'd like to just touch on a little bit. And I'm sure there are things that are hard to answer, so I guess we'll just see what happens. It seems to me like part of the benefit of a 4 day week is predicated on our sources of stress in our lives coming materially from work and being able to use our time outside of work as a recuperative time. My personal opinion or observation is that increasingly our private time is a stressful time. You talked about, I can't remember the phrase, you talked about like the state of the world at the moment. What do you think that relationship is between the broader environment, or what do you think that balance is between sources of stress inside and outside of work, and how does that play into the effectiveness of this intervention?
Yeah, I think balance is the key word there. So life outside work is stressful. That's to do with the state of the world, but it's also to do with life admin. And in 2024, most adults of working age are working. And if we reflect back to the 1970s, much less of the working age population were working because there were a lot of women not in employment, or if they were in employment, part-time working. And when you look at the labour force survey, is a really fascinating collection of data, and you can access all of this publicly. It's basically UK government data. And you can see that the proportion of families or households where there are two adults in full-time employment, it's now at like 80% or something. So who on earth is doing all the domestic labour? And when is it being done? It's being done outside of full-time work. And that is not leaving enough time for rest and recuperation. So I think the time outside of work is stressful because you're having to do non-paid work. And so we're doing paid work and non-paid work, and there's just not enough time left for leisure and the restorative activities that humans biologically need. And I think the four-day week is about balance, because in giving people that time for life admin away from work, you then create the balance to have more recuperation time. On the flip side, sometimes people say, oh, well, why do we need to stop at a four-day week? How about a three-day week or a two-day week or a zero-day week? And I usually reflect on this by saying, I think we're looking for a sweet spot here whereby you have balance, because there is so much psychological research showing that underemployment is really harmful for mental health, for physical health. And in fact, unemployment and significant underemployment is worse for you in terms of mental health and physical health than being in full-time employment. So I don't think we should go too far down the other direction. I think what the four-day week is about is finding what, for me, is, I come at this from a biological lens. I think humans have a biological sweet spot whereby you're engaged in intellectual, engaging work where you also get a social benefit of seeing colleagues. There are so many benefits to work just beyond the finances. And that is why we see the harms that happen for people in unemployment. But there is a biological sweet spot where everything is in balance, where you're getting all the fantastic benefits of being in work, but not so much work on top of non-paid work that you don't get the recuperation time that the brain physically needs.
That's really helpful. And we opened up lots of pathways into very many interesting conversations there. But it leads me to ask, I guess, another question that's related to this, and you might give the same answer. How much of a benefit is associated with a change as opposed to the end state? Is this something that people would attenuate to? And part of the reason I ask is obviously our laws on labor over the last 150 years have shifted significantly, as have the hours we spend in labor, right? And so there's been a huge amount of change. How much of this benefit do you think is due to a percentage change? And maybe an addendum question, how much of this is due to a change that other people don't have, right? So just, have you got thoughts on either of those?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I'll speak to a kind of meta level and then a scale level. So as we've said, there have been some historical changes here, whereby go back to Victorian times, it was quite normal to work 6 days a week and probably 10 plus hours. And then over many decades, there was a shift in social norms towards, at least for middle class men through the 20th century, of, you know, Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. And certainly that's an improvement, right? But then through the latter half of the 20th century, you know, and in the last two decades, there's been another societal shift whereby, as we said earlier, like most adults are working most of the time now. And that was not the case 70 years ago. And we've had some efficiencies in technology like dishwashers, but nevertheless, the fact that we still need to do some unpaid domestic labour, and the fact that there is no longer an untapped market of domestic labour, means that I think we're ripe for another social norm shift. And as a psychologist, my perception of how much time people spend at work, this is entirely socially constructed. There is no God-given decree of 37.5 hours or 40 hours or 50 hours or 32 hours is quotes, the correct amount of time to work. And the fact that we've seen that historical shift over many decades from Victorian times to the 20th century shows that social norms can shift. But I think our social norm on how much time we spend in paid work in 2024 has not kept pace with the demographic societal shifts in gender equality. But then to speak on a more micro level and looking towards the future, there's this question of when do we attenuate to the benefits? Employers were asking me this. Oh, okay, so you're seeing a slight boost to productivity. Oh, so you're seeing better sleep, burnout. But once you've had the four-day week for a year, you just normalize to that, right? You get accustomed to it, and then maybe your good habits go out the window. And that productivity win that we got, unfortunately, now has been lost because people are now just taking this for granted. So we've started doing some follow-up analyses, and we've been finding out what happened 6 months down the line from the original trial period ending. And our data so far are suggesting that if anything, it gets better. So burnout has gone down further, sleep problems have gone down further, and productivity has gone up a little bit as well. We're still gathering data on the 6 month follow-ups because we still have employers sort of working their way through the timeline. So that's a smaller sample size at the moment. So I can't say with 100% certainty yet, but that looks like the direction that our data are heading in. And in the national trial that was done in the UK in 2022, they've just did an 18-month follow-up. And I don't know if you saw in the media a couple of weeks ago that the news was released that 89% of the employers who entered the trial are still doing a four-day week 18 months on. So the large majority have kept going with it, suggesting that it's still doing what they want it to do.
But super helpful. I think it's fascinating that you see sustained or increased benefits so far. That's really interesting.
We should, of course, flag the 10%, 11% who haven't continued. Again, just to have full transparency and help people understand the nuances of it. But there's some early data from my colleagues in the national trial on what was it about those people who ultimately chose not to continue. And it turns out they were a subgroup who had really, really high burnout scores to begin with. And so we need to dig down to this in a lot more detail, but we've been speculating amongst ourselves that this might be a subset who perhaps either didn't have so much preparatory work or the workload was just so high to begin with, the four-day week, they just couldn't find the adaptations to make it work. And so perhaps they were continuing to do lots of overtime. So as we've touched on, there are the efficiency tips and tricks and small tweaks and wins. But sometimes, unfortunately, there's a bit of a wider issue around workload that the four-day week is not necessarily going to resolve by itself as a silver bullet. So it might be useful for people to just have at the back of their minds going into it. Occasionally, it doesn't work out. But our suspicion is that's because there's something else going on in terms of, you know,
work. Yeah, that makes sense. Something structural in terms of work design or shaping. And my guess is that there are certain industries where there would be a negative view on this anyway that makes it a little bit harder. A couple of other, I guess, questions that come to my mind, again, in this slightly broader space. You spoke about things like labor market participation earlier, and we covered some of the, you know, the shifting gender contribution to labor market participation. One of the things we know is very much the case at the minute is there's a reasonable level of a sort of health-related absence from working age populations, particularly in the UK. It's increasing. From a trend perspective, that seems to be the case. What do you think the role of something like a four-day week is in shaping contribution to something like national productivity, if you wish, if you want to take it that far, or more broadly, the labour market participation across the world?
Yeah, absolutely. It's huge. Because again, if you look at labour force survey data of how many working days are lost to poor health, 50% of working days lost are due to mental health rather than physical health. So there's an epidemic here, not just of physical health leading to lower market participation, but mental health too. And I reflect back again to the biology of this. There's only so hard and fast you can push a human brain without letting it rest. And that's just our biology. And there are many strengths to this. There are many things we can do that machines cannot do. And AI is such a hot topic at the moment. I firmly believe it's never going to replace us because biologically there's creativity that the human mind can do that a machine cannot replicate. But for human brains to function at their optimum, we need to pay attention to that human biology. And it may be that there are some of us, I talked earlier about a spectrum. It might be that for certain demographics, that subcynic group who want to work 40 hours a week, maybe that's their biological optimum, and working less actually is stressful for them just due to the nature of psychological and biological makeup. But there'll be another group of people for whom 40 hours is just too much because it makes you really, really tired. And so if the option is to work 40 hours and just not manage it and you be mentally and physically ill because of it, or to work 32 hours, it's better to work 32 hours than not at all, right? So for that reason, a four-day week, I think, could be hugely valuable in increasing market participation for those groups. But then secondly, even leaving aside the underparticipation of those groups, in those who switch, they tend to see better performance and revenue tends to go up. So even if you were being really cynical about, oh, the lovely, fluffy well-being benefits, why would you not do this, given the potential economic benefits that are on offer? And that can apply at the single organisation level. But if we add all of that up across the economy, why would we not do this? And this is going to be a terribly controversial point, depending on where you personally sit on a political value spectrum. But there's this really interesting example of the four-day week trial that South Cambridgeshire District Council have been running. Have you heard of this, James?
I've seen some of the headlines about it, yeah.
And the headlines... And I think
central government mandate shift and despite benefits and so on. And
The headlines have been flowing for over nearly a year now. So they tried this initially in a sub-team where they had a real retention issue and they were very reliant on agency bank staff and they were spending a lot. And it worked really well and it solved their retention issue. And over that time period, apparently they saved £300,000. And so they thought, okay, this has been really effective. And we're now going to consider rolling this out to another sub-team where we've, again, got a bit of a retention issue of bin men. I think the original team was planning something like that, where there was also a knock-on impact on customer service, where, like, if you've got planning application underway and then the consultant leaves, like, there were then all these delays happening because of the loss of expertise and internal, like, in-house knowledge of that particular application. And then bin men, like, this is an essential service. We all need bin men. But they have to work really hard at unsociable hours. Like, are we surprised there's a retention issue here? But at this point, central government got wind of it. And despite the fact that the council had saved money, I think this shows how ideology can play in. They said taxpayers expect value for money and you're not giving taxpayers value for money. So stop your experiment. And the council wrote back and said, we've actually saved money and we think we're going to save more. So even if you leave aside the fluffy benefits, like, economically, why would we not do this? And there's now this constant pushback, which is being covered by the media, where it's become a bit intractable, I think.
Yeah. And you've said a few times, why would we not do this? And I was going to come back and ask you, why would we not? But I think you've hit on some of this here. I think a personal view, there's something in the competitive nature of humanity that values an ability to persevere despite the adversity. And there's weakness in not doing this. There's language like that that comes out. Anecdotally, I observe a shift in, I guess, sort of social conversations across a range of things, including things like ESG investment or other aspects, you know, global warming, so on, all these things that make it harder and harder for people to do this. And we have, you know, Elon Musk saying, you know, work only gets hard at 80 hours, right? Or we get somebody with their daily plan that they share as a successful person, which involves, you know, going for their 6-mile run at 4 a.m. before 3 hours of meditation before kids to school, right? I mean, these things are hard, but they're true. And as a competitive species, how do we create that shift to make it permissible and acceptable and celebrated to be that different person? I think there's some real challenge in there. So that's not a question to, I guess, answer now because it's fairly hard, but I think there is something really interesting in that.
I think I can give a brief reflection.
Yeah, please.
At the moment, this is largely being led by SMEs in the private sector who are generally led by someone who thinks, oh, I've seen the data, and I think this could be a good thing for a number of reasons, and they're open to experimentation. But until there's wider movement in the landscape, in the public sector, and a role for legislation, I think it's not going to move very far beyond those private sector, experimentally positive mindset, minded employers. And this is a very febrile time for politics, as you know, the South Cambridgeshire District Council trial shows. And I think that's one reason why it's all the more important experiments are done in those other settings. It would no way could this happen overnight, but if there's a role for legislation in just doing a few more pilots in wider sectors and settings, then we can start to get a better handle on the data of, oh, okay, these are the benefits that happen. They're slightly different to private sector, or, oh, actually, the benefits aren't there that we thought they were. So maybe we'll have to, I don't think that would happen, but you know, as a scientist, I want to be data led. And I think we need to start gathering data from a wider set of sectors. And for that, there is going to need to be a role for legislators like district council.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd be interested to see things looking more broadly across different countries as well. You hear a lot of stories about sort of productivity in the US, and there's considerably less time for holidays. People don't take holidays. Working hours are different. I mean, there are interesting narratives that come out of that sort of division of workplace legislation between different parts of the world that I think are interesting. And I'd be kind of curious on the impact of autonomy on all of this as well. Just as we were speaking, I was kind of wondering, like, it feels like if we're doing labor in the 3 days that we're not in work, but we're doing it fully under our own terms versus maybe having less autonomy in the workplace, I wonder if there is something to do with the amount of autonomy we're giving in the workplace, if it might be another factor that contributes to this maybe.
It's something we've been measuring, and it's something the national trials have looked to measure as well, because we think it might be a moderator. So that's a bit of a scientific jargony word, but essentially that might have a consequence on the magnitude of the outcome. And there are potentially different consequences for the knowledge economy type workers like you and I, where other than meetings being set, we have quite high autonomy over task selection versus being on a production line versus in the care sector. So neither I nor my colleagues on the national trial have got stuck into that aspect of the data yet, but we hope over the next few years to be able to give a little bit more insight into that.
Yeah, very exciting. Well, let's watch this space. I think we're kind of out of time, but just to wrap up, is there anything people can do to find out more about you, about your work, about anything else you're doing, about how to get in touch? It's super exciting times.
Absolutely. Great to learn more. Yeah, so our website, www.sussex4dayweek.co.uk, and that's four with a number four, has lots of information about our results so far, quotes from those who've given it a try and what their experiences were, and our contact details. So you're very, very welcome to get in touch with us if you would like any advice. Very, very happy to chat to people on a completely informal, just answering FAQs basis. You don't have to be at the point of thinking, oh yeah, I want to do a trial. If you're at that point, then we can help you with that too. And we support employers through from very early FAQs, through to the preparatory work, through to doing a lot of detailed measurement and assessment, so that you've then got an evidence base of some hard numbers to make a decision on, has the trial done what you wanted it to do? As well as myself, based at the University of Sussex, and we support employers up and down the country, but as well as myself, there's the 4-Day Week Campaign UK, who I very much recommend for a great set of FAQs, some of which we've actually touched on and answered around, does a 4-Day Week mean everyone's off on Friday? No, often not. But if you are an employee, a member of staff rather than a business owner, and you like the idea of this and you want to bring it to your boss, I'm very happy to help advise you on that. But the 4-Day Week Campaign also have a fantastic advice page for if you're an employee, here are the sorts of things that you can do to raise it with your line manager or business owner. And then finally, the 4-Day Week Global Foundation have another fantastic set of resources. For if you want to take a really deep dive, you can go and find report, 60-page report from the national trial to download from their website, as well as reports from their other cohorts. Because they're global, they have been supporting national trials now in, I think, nearly 30 countries around the world. So you can go and look at all of their insights and data. That's 4dayweek.com.
Wonderful. Okay, excellent. Well, thank you very much, Charlotte. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, James.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Don't forget, as well as these podcasts, we deliver at least one free online seminar every month that everyone can attend. You can sign up for these and our newsletter, The Wow Mail, on our website, www.worldofwork.io. That's www.worldofwork.io.